Thank you for organizing this nice workshop. The order of presentation for this work, which is an ongoing work, will be follows. First, I'll be talking about connecting colliders and cosmology through cosmological constants. So that's sort of the main theme that I would like to try to present. And you'll see that it's an old idea, but the details of some of it is what I'm trying to flesh out in more detail. And then the second is using thermal dark matter conjecture as probe of cosmology, similar to BDN. And in particular, I'll try to use this for the first one. What that really means is if we measure something about dark matter, then we have another period of cosmological history that we can, in principle, probe, just like nuclear reactions can teach us, in principle, something about Big Bang nucleosynthesis time period. And finally, I close with our recent work on gravity waves, also as a probe of early universe cosmology. All right. Okay, so the relevance of particle physics for dark energy is not new at all, obviously, given that the cosmological constant problem is predicted by particle physics, the standard model. And so far, the relevant UV-IR connecting dynamics that is the promised land for solving the cosmological constant problem really hasn't found its concrete realization yet. And landscape conjectures basically say many possibilities for vacuum exists. So trying to find the cosmological constant problem solution is like trying to look for why the Earth is a particular distance away from the sun. And this is obviously possible, but somewhat disappointing, and it's hard to test convincingly. Okay, so this is sort of a cartoon version of how the cosmological constant problem predicted by the standard model is viewed upon by particle physicists today. And so phase transitions are predicted by particle physics, and the couple of phase transitions that you well know of are QCD phase transition, electrophoric phase transition, and these obviously also add to the vacuum energy problem, which is coming from this UV contributions from particle physics as well. So these are purely infrared historical contributions. Okay, so that's the state of the cosmological constant in a cartoon, and then we now want to say what new experimental developments are soon expected in terrestrial particle physics that may actually teach us something regarding this very old problem in particle physics. And one thing that we know, or we are almost sure to bet on, is the fact that we'll find a Higgs because of the WW scattering unitarity bound. And electric precision fits also sort of push us towards lighter even Higgs masses. And also, we might get lucky enough, and just from the usual famous WIMP dark matter cross-section calculation, you might say that we might be able to measure the dark matter's non-gravitational interaction through the next generation of collider experiments. And of course, this is backed up by other cosmological measurements/anomalies that might be hinting that we might actually have something out there that's annihilating, contributing to the various excesses that we see in the cosmic ray. All right, so now the question is, given that these are what we expect from the particle physics side, can they shed any light on the age-old problems that I've delineated in the slide before? Okay, so the idea that I'm going to be exploring is the following. The Higgs sector, through its infrared contributions from the phase transition, can in principle shed light on the that contribution to the cosmological constant if we can measure all the properties of the electric sector. Okay? And then so that's that the measurement of the electric sector, the Higgs sector, will give us hint about how to understand the phase transition. And so if we can have some cosmological handle on the phase transition, then we'll learn something about a particular contribution to the cosmological constant. So that's one idea. And the other is, as I said sort of at the beginning of the talk, that the dark matter sector in the future, if we're lucky enough, can be like the nuclear physics sector constraining the BBN period, but now at much higher energies. All right. So. So first, so let's talk about the electric phase transition. The textbook story is simply that the interaction of the classical Higgs field with the thermal plasma leads to effective interactions that correct the Higgs effective potential and give you symmetry restoration at high temperature. In intuition, it's actually very, very simple to understand. So formally, what you're doing is you're just trying to compute the partition function associated with, say, here, psis or fermions. So I have this box basically full of fermions, okay? And I want to compute the partition function by integrating them out, and that gives me my effective potential. So what I'm really just trying to compute when I do these computations at one loop is simply characterize the energy associated with the gas of fermions in this case. So for example, the energy in the fermion goes like the typical energy times the number density, and the number density goes like the Fermi Dirac distribution. This has no divergence in the because the denominator is finite, so it goes like omega to the fourth. And then if you look at the dispersion relationship for omega, then it has a typical momentum scale of p squared. And then it has an interaction energy as it's propagating through a background phi field, like y squared phi squared, where y's are, say, the Yukawa couplings that govern the phi. And then so this has a high temperature expansion if I pull off the p squared. Okay, and I get that. And then therefore rho f, which goes like omega to the fourth, just is the fourth power of that. And you see that just from this intuitive argument, you recover this phi squared p squared contribution to the energy density. Okay, so this is all that you're effectively computing whenever you're doing these thermal integrals at one loop. All you're doing is just looking at a bunch of particles and looking at dispersion relationships that depend on the field. Bosons have a much richer structure, particularly because of the non-analyticity in the denominator. So you can go through the same argument, except you have to treat the mode if the summation allows a summation over the infrared mode where omega over p is going close to zero, then you have to treat this mode separately. And if you just do the mode close to zero separately, this becomes 1 plus omega over t, 1's cancel. 1 power of omega cancels, and you get a t omega cubed. And the omega to the fourth is just like before. And this one essentially leads to this non-analytic structure, which can lead to cubic light. So these would be for this kind of bosonic. All right, so and these will play a role in my talk later on, talking about first-order phase transitions for gravity waves. But so basically, bosons have these extra physics structure associated with bosons. All right, so basically, the thermal effective potential, in summary, for every degree of freedom is just this well-known integral. Okay, and what it does is, if the potential at very low temperature was this, you keep raising the temperature, the shape of the potential changes, okay, which just accounts for the energy partitioning into your gas of particles, your gas in the box. All right, so basically now when you account for all the fields, it's just a bunch of counting and a bunch of standard factors. But let me just say one thing. So basically, so this is the object that we were just talking about. And you can semi-qualitatively and semi-quantitatively when you're lucky enough for your model, write it in this particular simple polynomial expansion. And otherwise, the field dependencies are a little bit more complicated because there are square roots. But generically, schematically, you can write it something like this. And then you see that one thing that you should realize about this kind of computation that's supporting your potential is that the most important term typically is this C1 T squared phi squared term. And this C1 is actually, it has some discrete structure, which is very clear because it's actually simpler to see it here. So if mass is much larger than T, exponential is zero, which means log of one is zero, so it doesn't actually contribute. Okay, so that's why basically the functions that are contributing to this one loop thermal correction has different behavior whether you're looking at large, small masses or large masses compared to the temperature. And whether it's bosons or fermions, obviously, has that different analytic structure. And then for the bosonic case where you have that non-analyticity, you have infrared divergences that you contain by doing these Bayesian summations, and which just amounts to replacing zero temperature masses with thermal masses. All right, so these are well known, okay. And the only thing that you should keep in mind is that this thing is discrete, that's supporting the potential. Once the mass drops, mass becomes too much larger than the temperature, it you lose the support of your potential coming from that particular species. All right, so now the bottom line is these corrections lead to, in principle, uplift of the minimum of the effective potential of your Higgs. Okay? All right, and that is what I'm going to explore. Okay, so to make that statement precise, okay, a crucial assumption was made in drawing that V at temperature T very close to zero today has been tuned to zero by a cosmological constant. Okay? So I can, without any, as long as I'm doing the computation without worrying about the gravitational back reaction, I can decouple that thermal gas property as compared to the cosmological constant, and I can shift the cosmological constant, I can tune it to zero. And this is consistent with large class of idea. It just says if I look at the minimum of the potential, then that's going to be zero. Okay, so I just adjust some constant. Right. So that's assumption one. When I drew that uplift at finite temperature, okay, to contribute to the dark energy. Point two, vacuum energy can be read off only if the VEV is sitting at the local minimum. And the movement of that can be energetically neglected. So this K is associated with basically 1/2 phi dot squared during cosmological evolution. And the third thing, just a side remark, all of these are just to orient your mind for intuition, is the fact that the energy density isn't simply just the potential added on top of kinetic and zero temperature U, because what you're actually doing is doing this sum minus P plus TS plus mu at M. So it's related to the potential. The pressure is identically the thermal potential, but the energy density is a little bit different, but qualitatively almost. Any questions on the intuition? Okay, so given that we've established what I mean regarding the basic assumption for this uplift delta V, the question is now, can we actually probe this delta V? How large is the magnitude and what can you probe it with? This question. And cosmologically, it obviously couples to gravity, this delta V. So anything that can probe Hubble expansion rate can probe this delta V. And I'm going to, in this talk, focus on dark matter and gravity wave. Yeah, that's right.
So what is the lowest order dependence on temperature?
Something I misunderstood. When you calculate the vacuum density of the standard Higgs potential, you get 10 to the power of 56 times what you want to get.
Yeah.
So how, what do you do about that?
Oh, so that's the point. I remember that was when I established the scenario that you're doing a fine tuning to set the zero temperature minimum of the potential to zero.
So you fine-tuned to 56 decimal places.
That's right. So this is consistent with anyone who believes in landscape and without a very late time dynamic or relaxation mechanism or a tunneling at very late times.
Wouldn't it be less biased to just leave the lambda as a free parameter? In other words, why tune it exactly to zero?
It doesn't. So it turns out, as you see, only thing that I care about is that whatever the mechanism is that's tuning this V, that it does not dynamically participate in the energy partition. In other words, whatever epoch I'm trying to probe this delta V with, okay, so I have some probe, which, for example, changes the shift in H because of delta V. So whatever the energy that's what you call the cosmological constant, however it may vary, as long as that number is much smaller than this delta V I'm trying to probe, which is the height of this at any given temperature, it's irrelevant.
So you don't really have to tune the...
No, but I just said that. Yeah, I just said that just to orient people, zeroth order intuition, and then you can put that aside. Right. Okay, good. Okay, all right, so basically in that way, this gives a limited empirical proof of cosmological constant tuning, and as I said, the resolution of the tuning depends on what epoch you look at. All right, so let's see. Now, one thing that you have to be very careful when you do this is shift in H compared to what? Okay, so you know, what are you actually shifting H compared to? All right, so this is generically negligible, that's true. Okay. But then you have this very complicated field dependence in here. Should you include that in addition to this or not? That's one, you know, very zeroth order question. And the answer is, at one loop level, this correction is automatically taken care of by using ordinary Boltzmann equations with the right thermal field dependent masses. So as long as you're some code monkey that's writing your Boltzmann code, but you're making sure you're doing all the thermal corrections for your dispersion relationships correctly, okay, then all of these corrections will automatically be taken into account. Okay, at one loop level. And there are higher loop corrections due to the fact that phi shift, but those are higher order, and you can include that if you're good, okay? But something that's intrinsic to the equation of state of minus one that's giving me the dark energy contribution, that what we would call intrinsically the physical cosmological contribution, comes from this part. Okay, it's the pure field potential. Okay, that's the honest, real field potential associated with the fact that Higgs field is not at where zero, it's found is at zero time. Okay. All right. So basically, that's my answer to shift in H compared to what? Shift in H with or without taking U into account. So delta rho, rho with U minus rho without U. And that, I'm claiming, is sensitive to any relaxation mechanism, a class of relaxation. I'm not defining precisely what because it's not unique. But I can imagine many different types. Right. All right, so that's my definition of delta. Yes, that's because phi that goes into here is phi dependent temperature. It's not a... Okay, so again, to read this off, if there exists a relaxation mechanism for the cosmological constant which makes U contribution vanish or different, measurement of delta HH over H will constrain such mechanisms. And key hope is the collider will allow us to measure the Higgs sector sufficiently accurately, and cosmological probes will improve measuring this. Okay, so that's the idea. All right, now let's get to the particle physics. So how much does H shift typically? Okay, so you can do a more complete calculation, but this actually suffices to understand where the magnitudes are coming from. Okay, so first, for example, if we look at standard model, the cubic term is weak. Even if the cubic term is strong, you can show that it's an order one correction to the story that I'm going to tell you. And so for now, I can simply just neglect cubic. And then you find a very clean formula for U of phi m. Okay, so this is phi at the minimum, okay, of this potential at finite temperature T. And again, I'm not just minimizing and putting phi m back into here. This is U, not V. Okay, it's the field part of the potential, okay, not the kinematic correction to the fact that you're doing a high temperature expansion, which is completely arbitrary.
Not bounded from below.
Yeah, but except phi to the fourth.
So you drop the phi cube potential.
Yeah, but it's typically okay. All right. Okay, so now when you take this field energy, then you see your G star
with no field also goes like T to the fourth, so T parts cancel, and you end up with this very mildly temperature dependent G star. And lambda and C, they all have temperature dependences, but over some finite segment patch of temperature, they're actually constants. Okay, so that's it. Okay? All right, and to drive home this point of the segments, this C, which appears here, which comes from there, and note that it comes with C squared, not C, is roughly behaving like this. Here, I just try to give you an intuition by Taylor expanding about the zero of phi, okay, because this is phi squared, so I'm trying to extract a quadratic field-dependent part out of it. So it goes like 1 over some 0.1 type number times phi dependence on the mass squared. Okay, second derivative. So, for example, there's a fermion term, same thing. So if you have a Yukawa coupling, the mass of the fermion is y times phi. So mass fermion squared is y squared phi squared. And then two derivatives just will give you y, right? So then this is just basically y squared. Okay. All right, so now you can now, let's just see what we get for the standard model.
Because you're changing GS star effectively, right? Okay. So you're adding U to rho null field. So you have your GS star is, you have an effective GS star which is different from your original GS star. Is that true?
Not really, because G star is actually only counting by definition T to the fourth part of your energy density.
Yes. Well, the G star has T dependence itself.
Yeah, but U of phi is not actually associated with the particles. Remember, so what's happening? So particles are getting some energy because they're interacting with phi, but then there's a separate phi degree of freedom which contributes its own potential energy.
So that I understand, but in terms of just back expansion history versus temperature, so instead of H squared being G star T to the fourth, it's a different, it's a renormalized G star T to the fourth. Yeah. It's still proportional to T to the fourth, isn't it? Or?
Only because I wrote it in terms of phi of m. But,
okay.
But it's intrinsically the fact that the equation of state is associated with the fact it's a state. So equation of state is minus one, truly, because if you just follow most of these calculations after electric phase transition, except exactly electric phase transition, there's a lot of model dependence, but it just quickly oscillates and relaxes back to zero because, remember, expansion rate at electric phase transition, H is 10 to the minus 14 GeV. It's very, very slow expanding. So it quickly loses its kinetic energy and it sits.
The temperature decays as 1 over A.
That's right.
So then that's kind of contradictory. On the one hand, you say it's the equation.
That's only because your intuition is based on the fact that each rho dot equals 3H rho plus P is separately considered.
Okay, what do you think it's not?
Yeah, because it's actually the pressure that's supporting this. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, so back to the main story. Once you put the standard model number G star equals 106.75, and then write everything in terms of true level relations for simplicity, because you can't
write a closed form for non-true level relationship, then you see how this thing goes. So we have the C squared over lambda, and C depends on SU2, U1y, top Yukawa coupling. And so typically it's this one or this one that dominates the C, and this is basically lambda coupling constant, which is associated with the quartic coupling. Okay, just written in terms of Higgs mass. And so here it is. So basically you have C squared over lambda, so if this one becomes very large, then you have two powers of this, divided by one power of that, so you have one power of this left over. So you get some kind of enhancement when this is very large. When this is very small, then this term becomes negligible. This one relaxes to some value, but lambda then becomes small. Okay, so you basically have a peak in delta H over H for small Higgs mass and large Higgs mass. Okay, so that's easy to see. Okay. And so basically delta H over H is this. Now, so it's the depressing news, right? Because look at the axes, left hand side, this is delta H over H. So maximum you get on the lower end and the higher end is, you know, barely 0.5%. Okay. So gonna be very, very hard to measure anything to 0.5% accuracy. So, go ahead.
T minus to WW, that let 2 is measured to 100%.
Oh, yeah, except as I'll tell you that this one that I just told you about, this one was for T of, close to 100 G.
Okay.
So remember, I said as soon as your temperature goes below the mass scale of whatever is running around your thermal loop, you decouple that object. Okay, so C becomes discontinuous, right? So basically, this is for the spectrum that's running around in the thermal loop at about T equals to 100 GeV. And then the numbers get much worse when you go lower time. I'll talk. All right. So this is the best we can do with this delta H over H of about, you know, 0.5%. But it's not impossible. Okay, I think it's hard, but maybe not in my lifetime, somebody's lifetime, it might be. Go ahead.
This number, how much does it depend on the state of the model? Or
yeah, so I'm going to talk about both of them.
Okay.
Yeah, it's both, lots of issues. All right. So, and another caveat. This has error on both ends. I neglected the cubic term. When Higgs mass is very small, the cubic term can be very important. So, but that's an order one correction up here. And when MH is very large, and I cut it off here because that's basically tree level unitarity bound. And so what you have is then a strongly coupled sector, your perturbation theory breaks down. So both ends are not quite good, but that should be approximate. Yeah.
Global fits to electro weak data with the Higgs mass between 150 and 135. Which,
yeah, yeah,
which is the worst place for you.
That worst, it's not so bad. Okay, it's right here. I mean, it's a typical value.
You're talking about, I just want to make sure I understand. You're talking about seeing this in the expansion rates, cosmic expansion.
Yeah.
And what redshift are we talking about?
So I'll get to
that. Huge.
That's right, that's right. So that's why, I remember at the beginning of the talk, I said I would talk with the probes as well as this.
So there is nothing in BDM that we know better than 4%. So.
Yeah, I know, I understand. On the other hand, I think BDM systems are could be massive in principle. It doesn't have to be necessarily cleaner because of nuclear physics.
No, not because of that. Because of the difficulty of extracting from modular abundance system observation.
Oh, that's true. You're right.
Nuclear physics is.
You're right. That's true. That's
no
true.
Error.
Right. That's true. In principle, we might be able to have better observables, but I don't want to say.
CMB can do it in principle.
But. Yeah, but I'll show you why. You have to stick around 100 GeV. It doesn't work. All right.
CMB is not sensitive to the masses of dark matter. I mean, just for the range, yes.
Well, so maybe he's got it.
All right. Okay, good. All right, the lesson.
In standard model, extensions with similar structure desired deviation as small as it must fight the degree of freedom suppression. So, I mean, basic intuition is trivial. You have energy, which are partitioned among G star degrees of freedom. Higgs affects a few species that you count in G star. And that's those few species which are dominant contributions supporting your potential is giving rise to the pressure that's keeping your phi field up. Force driving the VEF to true minimum is balancing this pressure, okay? And this force is basically set by the weak scale because that's the mass scale, the zero temperature potential, okay? So that's why this has a suppression of 1 over G star. Because you can only affect a few out of the many degrees of freedom. How many? Whatever C squared counts. Remember, C was the thing that was running around the thermal loops. Okay? So unless if you have a hugely degenerate spectrum, for some reason, suddenly we find maybe Kaluza-Klein towers or something, large extra dimensions, or you know, build funny models, then it's not gonna be particularly different. This. All right, so let's talk about lower temperature. I mean, just to be more explicit and how depressing it is. So if we look at lower temperature, say, let's go at G star T equals to 110 MeV, 10.75, you might say, oh, 1 over 10.75, great, we have order 10%. Well, of course, it's not going to work because when you look at this, okay, basically, each of these contributions in the sum, which are order 0.1 numbers, decouple whenever the mass becomes much larger than the temperature. And basically, so the strength of this is given by mass, second derivative of the mass. And the second derivative of mass in standard model-like theories is basically mass squared divided, the field-dependent part of mass squared divided by 246 GeV squared. Okay, that's the slope because they're pushed down by the BEV. Okay, and we just said this mass, whatever it is, has to be less than the temperature. So every coefficient here is bounded above. Yeah.
So the only thing you can
play around with is the number in the sum. In the standard model, basically, you have gauge bosons, Higgs, and a top quark. That's it, at 100 GeV and at lower temperatures.
They're screwed. OK. At lighter particles, each of those will contribute whatever temperature you're looking at them at divided by 246. So 10 MeV divided by 246 GeV is negligible. So C is close to zero. So even though this is 1 over 10, doesn't matter. C squared is completely negligible. All right. How about beyond standard model? OK, from generic arguments we've
given before, natural models are unlikely to give orders of magnitude enhancement. And I've explicitly checked this for MSSN and NMSSN. Okay. And finally, fine-tuned multiple scalar models should exist. And it's pretty obvious it should. But I was trying to work on it this weekend. I couldn't quite get it. But I'm close. OK. But it's just academic exercise. Because basically, you know, you can have something like hybrid inflation where things are rolling and then you roll down to your standard model minimum. And so basically, what you're trying to do is you're trying to basically inflate. All right. So you have basically thermal support and then the temperature goes down. But basically, to get to your true minimum at zero temperature, you have to roll a very, very long way. And if you have some flat direction with a singlet, okay, then you can, in principle, tune. But look at the tuning. Okay, this phi f is some VEV that you're eventually rolling down in the singlet direction to make sure that your thermal density is going down faster than your energy density because you're rolling. Okay, and then if phi f is much smaller than mp, then you have to basically tune your potential like crazy in terms of flattens. Right? So it's not going to work with anything natural. But I just still want to come up with a contrived model that, in principle, does this. OK, anyway, I haven't quite succeeded.
But I'm pretty sure it exists.
How about thermal inflation?
Yeah, something like thermal inflation. So thermal inflation relies on those intermediate mass scales to give you sufficiently flat dimensions. That's what I said. All right, so good. Now we're
done with that part. And so now we talk about the probes, as you were interested in. So let's see, how good can we do with probes? All right, so suppose I'm some miracle model builder, and then I'm miraculously lucky enough to get something in nature that actually gives you a larger delta H over A, say 5%, and then we all are happy. How would we probe them if the effects are all near maximizing your 100 GeV? Okay, so there are three things that I can think of so far that I've worked on. One is dark matter, second is gravity wave, and third is barogenesis, and I'll talk about each. All right, so you can already imagine what dark matter probes are like. As discussed in the intro, dark matter property is something new, expected to be measured at the LHC. And hence, it is appropriate to explore what we can learn about the cosmology of this. With thermal relics, so this is a big assumption, we can probe at H at the time of freeze-out. So parametrically, omega H squared, people usually don't write it this way, but it does depend on cosmology. It depends on H at the freeze-out. Okay? For example, in the standard cosmology, if this just is radiation dominated, then this is T squared over M Planck, XM, where X is defined to be T over M. That's just T squared over M Planck. And you see, you get the mass cubed, canceling out this mass cube. So you famously recover the fact that in ordinary radiation dominated wind, thermal wind calculation, you don't have any mass dependence in the final relic abundance. But in general, you know, H could be some complicated function, and this cancellation may not occur. Okay. And basically, in this formula, this XF is something like 1 over 20 with all of the rest of the dependence logarithmically changing. Okay. And so basically, only particle physics is here, and most of the cosmology is here.
Yeah. We don't. But I have to keep doing theoretical cosmology.
So. You don't put it really in the sand, I'll talk about it a little bit.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So Lisa's going to talk about this much more.
But my main point is stay tuned for her talk. But basically, this is nowhere close to being even somewhat complete in the catalog of, if I have one discrepancy that I can fix by saying that I have some extra cosmological constant contribution or some extra dark matter contribution at any given epoch, I can't just with one single measurement pin down which extra contribution that's changing my Hubble expansion rate is. Okay? It could be a cosmological constant. It could be some other dark matter that we didn't think of before. Maybe there are many dark matter, okay? Or maybe the gravity, a scalar tensor gravity is doing funny things, and some modifications to gravity. Okay, so anyway, so all of this is viewed upon as a probe that gives you one hint, and then you have to connect many probes together. She'll talk much more about how this happens, but basically you're trying to look for discrepancy between colliders and astrophysics measurement, trying to get a hint on whether you should believe there are some shifts in H compared to with and without some contribution. So this is what I mean. So you have a dark matter by itself, it's not going to tell you anything. Once you fix this, you might be able to fix something about the gravitational wave signature. If you measure it, that's great. And then once you fix those two, you might be able to predict something about that. And of course, you know, given that if the numbers stay at 0.5%, all of it's completely academic. If you can find models that are bigger, then it might actually be worth something. Okay. And note that for the dark matter, the freeze-out temperature goes like basically the mass of the object. So if the mass is very large, then the freeze-out temperature is order or close to a TeV. If freeze-out temperature, say, order 50 GeV, then the mass of the dark matter is a TeV. And remember, we need to probe H close to 100 GeV. Right? Okay. So that's where the dark matter probe will come in. All right, and then Lisa will talk about some other conjectures which can be tested much more generally, but that's her talk. Okay, next.
You're talking about dark matter probe, you just mean the density of dark matter, or is there anything else about dark matter?
The main point is I measure at colliders all the parameters necessary for computing the cross section.
So that part I understand, but the cosmological part.
And then I assume thermal relic abundance, and then you're trying to compare that with all the constrained, global constrained fits to your dark matter. And you're trying to get the precision of the measurements sufficiently well on both sides to actually see a discrepancy with the standard calculation without a particular delta H contribution. And then you include a delta H, and if that fits, then you make a prediction for, say, gravity wave or baryogenesis. That's the game.
But I'm just wondering, what are the cosmological observables that you have in mind for dark matter?
Dark matter, I mean, CMB global fits, structure formation.
But just the density of dark matter.
Yeah, that, density.
Right? Nothing. Because you can't imagine a small scale structure of dark matter as an external function.
I think in a global fit, they should all play a role, I think.
Yeah, in principle.
That, so I was really envisioning that you. A global constraint. Yeah, you, because I know the effects are going to be small, so you need global constraints. All right. Okay, so basically,
so there is a dark matter type of probe. And if you're lucky enough to find a dark matter candidate with a large mass, okay? Next, I'm going to talk about gravity wave probe. All right. So for the gravity wave story during electric phase transition, this cubic term plays an important role. If you have a cubic term, you can have a coexistence phase where part of your universe is sitting in a patch where it's at zero, part of the universe is sitting here where the order parameter is non-zero. And so you have a bubble of zero versus non-zero, okay? Bubble of non-zero expanding in a region of zero. Okay. So basically, in such cases, you can actually compute the bubble nucleation rate like this, and then you have some bubble growing solution. So phi equals zero, phi not equals zero, and then so not equals to zero. All right. Now, in the standard model, this bubble nucleation isn't very effective, and because it's actually a crossover, when people did the calculation very carefully, there is no phase transition. But many examples exist beyond the standard model. And this is some work in progress with my student. Consider the usual Z3-based MMSSM with the additional economical assumption of singlet playing the right-handed neutrino role. And then since I'm sort of running out of time, I'll just trust me that with a particular guess for how to parameterize this into a toy model with this, you can then start guessing which parameter region to look at, since it's an eight-dimensional parameter region, it's pretty hard to probe. And then you try to find what region you can find the phase transition. And after about a year and a half work, we found one region, one cluster of points. So, okay, so this is pure. I was, you know, it's nerve-wracking for a student, right? Year and a half searching for points.
You're trying to create
Let me explain. Okay. You take the potential and origin, that's fine, because your degree freedom is fixed, and then you have to find a temperature setting. But when you tunnel to the other side, there's no reason the same temperature should be there.
I agree.
The temperature can be zero, as another example.
Yeah.
So, but the potential that you use is not the potential that
in matching my previous calculation to this, you have to actually do much more careful averaging of what you mean by the vacuum energy. So yes, it's not obvious in a first order phase transition. That's correct. But it's still not impossible to define.
Oh, I can define. Suppose I take a Billy-Higgs model, right?
Yeah.
I have zero modes there.
Yeah.
The other side, it's massive.
Yeah.
No zero modes.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. I agree, but I've gone through that exercise with the toy model. You can do it. Okay.
So anyway, so here we're trying to just map onto the gravity wave signature. Okay. And okay, so now, so there exist models beyond the standard model which nucleates bubbles. They can collide. Okay. And then when they collide, then there are turbulent swirling motion as well as non-turbulent, well-defined envelopes associated with the bubble collisions. The turbulent motion, the calculation is much more uncertain. On the other hand, the non-turbulent envelope behavior, gravity waves from the envelope behavior is very easy to, not easy. It has a better calculational status at the moment. Okay, so now the thing that's important here is, again, you're basically looking at bubble nucleation rates, and then you're looking at something about their collision shape. Now, the key physical length scale that exists in such calculation is this delta T, which is the time it takes for the phase transition to complete towards the end of the phase transition. Okay, so this nucleation rate is not a constant. Okay, it actually increases towards the end of the phase transition. So you do a Taylor expansion, and then towards the end, depending on this dsdt, so this delta t goes like this, where this actually, this number can be fairly significant compared to h. So 1 over dsdt could be 1 over 100, for example. Okay, so for in a time period much shorter than the expansion rate, you can actually complete the phase transition, most of it, in that region. Okay, that is the key region in which key length scale that actually enters the gravity wave physics. Okay, and the computation of the gravity wave is just like what you learn in ENM for electromagnetic, roughly speaking. So the gravity wave can be expressed as a two-point function of h dot squared. Each h is the inverse propagator acting on t. And so when you act on the expectation value, you have to compute the correlators of t. And it involves the power spectrum of the bubbles of these electroweak bubbles that are being nucleated. And then here we make a ansatz kinematic splitting. This tells you the number of bubbles with particular sizes and shapes. This tells you the dimensionful magnitude of this stress energy tensor correlator. So if you note, this is the density, rest frame of the bubble density, bubble wall density, times the relativistic energy shift squared. Okay, so now if you are claiming that most of your dimensionful number for this is coming from that, then what you're actually assuming is disconnected diagrams. In other words, you're neglecting all interactions of the two bubble walls actually colliding. Okay, when they're colliding, they have interaction energy with exchange of whatever mediating particles that's mediating the interaction between the colliding bubbles. Okay? So with that approximation, which is actually standard in, say, all the literature, you can see them and the references therein. And so then you can write down this gravity wave in a very simple form, very easy to understand. This part, oh, I thought I started at 15, is that right? Oh, is that right? I didn't know that. Okay. Oh, okay. Okay, so basically, we can get to the end. So it turns out, because there's actually one scale in the gravity calculation that doesn't depend on the turbulence, it turns out you can get a very well-defined prediction for what the contamination of the Hubble expansion rate will do to the gravity wave spectrum, which is to shift the peak over by the change in the Hubble expansion rate. Okay, Q is the new Hubble expansion rate, H would be the one without the delta H, and then its amplitude decreases like 1 over xc squared. So it doesn't matter whose computation of the gravity waves you trust, as long as it's not the turbulent one, I'm telling you exactly how that their computation spectrum will change if you shift H, which is what we're trying to probe, this delta H. Okay, so instead of going like this, it's going to go like that, for example. Okay. All right, so since I'm out of time, I'll just conclude. Okay. So fine-tuning tuned cosmological constant conjecture may be testable by combining collider data and cosmology. And this is approximately the intuition formula. And the key killer is 1/g star. Okay, that the number of degrees of freedom at the electric phase condition is fairly low. Okay, dark matter candidate detection at colliders presents an interesting new probe of early universe cosmology, and gravity wave peak shift and amplitude are sensitive to Hubble expansion rate during electric phase transition in an exactly very simple calculable way.
Maybe you can take one more question from.
So would this gravity wave contribute to the R parameter that CMB constrained for BMOS? Is it
you wouldn't get a very predictive you would have an integrated effect since for the gravity wave spectrum calculation from inflation. You would have, if you were trying to say measure it on BDO, you would have to scale after it enters the horizon how it dilutes with the scale factor. That scale factor will have a shift that's going like delta H. So, but it'll be very minor because it'll be a tiny amount. Whereas this is the, at the location where it's actually produced, the actual peak shifts and the height goes down in exactly the same, with the same factor. Okay, peak shift is linear, the amplitude shift is quadratic. So it has a very distinct mark.
This is a very different scale from CMB.
So if you would have time, what was the what was the baryogenesis probe?
The baryogenesis probe is the weakest of them all, which is the fact that the stellar unbound, which goes like the E stellar un divided by temperature, has to be greater than about 34 to 45. You see the large uncertainty for you to not have a washout of the baryon that you just created in front of the bubble wall. That is dependent on H. So that number comes from balancing the washout stellar un rate with the Hubble expansion rate. So if you change the Hubble expansion rate, you change that number. Unfortunately, it's extremely weak because it's exponential. It's E to the E stellar un divided by temperature is equal to H. So you change H a little bit, you just change the E over P a tiny bit logarithmic.
Okay, so you have anything done?